Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Cheats, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today in studio is our co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
I'm operating out of a different studio today. I have guests in the house, and my usual studio is being taken up, so I'm stuck in my basement lair, which actually also acts as a pretty good studio, and it's cooler than my usual studios. Being the fact that it's going to be 100 degrees today, I'm in pretty good shape.
Well, yeah, I'll try to refrain from calling you Batman. we'll work with that. But, ladies and gentlemen, if you were with us today, you know that we started talking about an issue based on an article by Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post that was titled, Why Are Republicans So Awful at Picking Supreme Court Justices? Well, it's not a rhetorical question by far, because they are really, really awful at it, as history has shown, and we talked a little bit about that yesterday. I guess today, Chuck, we kind of really want to drill down into this whole idea of why we seem to, or conservatives, and I know we talked about the difference between constitutionalists, conservatives, and everybody else, why conservatives so easily fall for vague promises. When you get into a confirmation hearing, and we talked about this a little bit too yesterday, that a liberal, a hardcore liberal, is very honest about where they stand on issues such as abortion, homosexual, sodomy rights, those type of things. They're very forthright about it in their writings and in how they deal with the answers they have in their nominating hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, whereas the supposed conservative nominees must play cloak and dagger, that they talk about things such as stare decisis, that they talk about traditional jurisprudence. So there's all kinds of phrases that get thrown out there. But these phrases, Chuck, supposedly, according to many of the, shall we say, interpreters in the conservative media, are supposed to indicate this guy's a rock-rib conservative who will hold to a strict construction view of the Constitution and will be our good friend on all of these wonderful issues, both economic and social, that we hold dear in our conservative philosophy. However, the actual, as it says in some of the commercials, your results may vary. And it seems like our results have varied quite a bit when we see these people, after they get on the bench, start practicing this supposed original intent view of the Constitution.
You have to think in these terms. First of all, if they hold any kind of an ideology that is quote-unquote constitutionalist, and I prefer conservative in this case, because really, as we've noted on a number of occasions, conservative means basically that you are tending to conserve the mistakes that have been made before you came on the scene.
Yeah, which is why stare decisis is such a seductive term to conservatives, but who don't really understand exactly what it means or what they're saying when they say that they stand by stare decisis.
Well, I think they do understand what they mean. What they want to do is maintain the status quo.
Well, no, I don't mean the justices, Chuck. I mean all the folks out there who are rah-rah.
Yeah, and therein is the other problem, Barry, is the people that conservatives trust are questionable at best. People that we call conservative pundits are just that. They are conservative. They're not constitutionalist. In fact, if someone pops up who is a constitutionalist, they are marginalized quickly. And let me give you an example. The only reason that, for instance, people listen to Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams is that these are people who really do espouse something of a constitutionalist view. I think Williams is more of a libertarian, but he's a constitutional libertarian, and we don't want to get into the minutia of that. But the reason that they get listened to and they get paid attention on the right is because they're black. Now, I don't want to bring too much of a color issue, but these two fellows are actually kind of rare birds, because they have fallen outside of the mainstream on economics and politics and how they sit. So they get some attention. In fact, Walter Williams was doing Rush Limbaugh's show yesterday, and one of his guests was Thomas Sowell, which is always actually kind of a delight to listen to. That's about the only time I ever listen to Limbaugh is when Williams is hosting, because he's such an interesting fella. I don't always agree with him, but I find myself more in agreement with him in many cases than I do with Limbaugh. So that's one of the problems we're into, Barry, is we've also got a problem in that once a quote-unquote conservative president makes a choice, the quote-unquote conservative punditry closes ranks, and all of a sudden all we hear is rah, 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 we've got to pray for this person. We'll even hear people like Jay Sekulow saying things like, we've got to pray for the president's nominee and, you know, make sure that you... And some of these people are... We have no idea what their positions are. And as we talked about yesterday, the reason we don't know what their positions are is because they don't advertise them, unlike the other side, who can say things like, as Thiessen points out, basically Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, declared the right of abortion central to a woman's life, to her dignity, and she was confirmed 96-3. Okay, she got 99 votes in the Senate, 99 out of 100. Somebody wasn't there that day. Barry, there's something wrong with that when people who proclaim themselves... Now, if I remember right, one of the great leaders of the pro-life movement, who basically makes fun of a true constitutionalist, and that's Ron Paul, was Rick Santorum. And right. Rick Santorum, as I recall, voted yes for the Ginsburg nomination. Now, I could be wrong on that. I'd have to double-check that.
We can double-check that, but I think you're right.
But 96-3, I don't think he was one of the three. Stephen Breyer, as Thiessen points out, declared abortion a basic right and was confirmed 87-9. Got 87 votes out of 100. Only 9 voting no. Here's the facts, Barry. If a true constitutionalist came in and declared abortion was absolutely not a right, he would not be confirmed.
Oh, no, not in the least.
Republicans would not close ranks. He would be called divisive. He would be called a troublemaker. He would be called an ideologue. In fact, these people on the left are true ideologues, and yet they are confirmed by these huge margins. So what's going on? You have to ask yourself, what is going on? And the answer is that the culture is driving and by the culture, I mean basically the cultural gatekeepers, which is the media, is driving the country far to the left. Because what will happen is, you know, we'll get the old explanations. These guys are... It doesn't matter what their racial makeup is. They'll be painted as rich, white, country club Republicans.
Well, of course.
When, in fact, they may be the furthest thing from that there can be. The last time they tried that with David Souter, it just didn't work out. I mean, the guy who lived with his mother or something, you know, and off on a farm in you know, Nowheresville, and had no judicial record to speak of, and now that he has one, everybody says, oh my gosh, how did he get on the court? Well, he got on the court because the Republicans wanted to avoid what has become essentially a media proctological exam on candidates.
A la Clarence Thomas, yes.
Absolutely. Clarence Thomas, who called his hearing a high-tech lynching. And it was. It was an attempt. I mean, they pulled out all the stops. David Brock, before he went insane, basically came out and wrote that book, The Real Anita Hill, which he proved and then repudiated, even though the evidence is all there, and you can follow it yourself and show that Brock was correct when he wrote his book, that Anita Hill perjured herself in the hearings. Mm-hmm. And yet she's still a hero. She's still a hero, although she doesn't get as much press because somebody might actually ask her about some of the stuff that she did say and some of the evidence that's come out since. So this is the kind of thing that you get. It really doesn't matter what they say. They can say anything in the heat of the moment in order to defeat a true constitutionalist candidate. And when it comes out in the end, it was all a lie. They say, well, you know, that's politics.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the convenient way of changing that up. To just say, oh, that's just politics. You know, that's not a big deal.
Exactly. And this is the problem we run into, Barry. Yes, this is modern politics. It's not about who's right and who's wrong and where they stand on an issue. It's about how much emotion can we cook up to get our candidate through. You can see it in any number of situations. You can see it in the Trayvon Martin case. This is the same kind of politicking that's going on. In fact, basically, I read a comment the other day that this, I agree, this is off topic, but he has to be convicted or America will burn, is what has been said, and it looks like basically the fix is in on his trial. And because of the state of the bench, that may very well be the case.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, Chuck, that kind of brings us on to what's on most people's mind today in relation to the Supreme Court. And the whole idea of whether or not a justice is conservative or not has really been kicked into high gear with the recent ruling by five members of the court, including noted, quote-unquote, conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act as being constitutional because it's, drumroll please, a tax. So therefore, Congress, under their taxing powers under the Constitution, has the authority to pass the most sweeping changes to public law that have come in this or in many, almost any other generation. Now, many conservative commentators, Charles, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you've heard them all, have kind of run the gamut from being absolutely aghast to trying to desperately defend as being somehow very, very strict constructionist what John Roberts did, which was side with the four ultra-liberals on the court. That's Sonia Sotomayor, Alina Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer, and actually wrote an opinion giving the green light to what is now, I guess, it is law, but even if the Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't unconstitutional, it's still unconstitutional because we've done some things, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow, Saturday program, but we've done some things now in this country through our courts that have basically blown the doors off of any kind of checks and balances in our Constitution. It's okay for Congress to do whatever they want to now, according to John Roberts, as long as they can buttonhole it under certain clauses in the Constitution and make it work. Now,
exactly, Barry.
The big problem was they were trying to put it under the Commerce Clause, and so in order to make it constitutional, he had to invent an expanded power under the Article 1, Section 8 clause of Congress having the power to tax.
Well, and then he had to combine it with basically the 16th Amendment in order to make it work, because the power to tax was limited by you can't pass a capitation. Well, this is clearly a capitation, if you know what I'm saying. This is a direct tax, and a direct tax was not allowed under the old Constitution before it was changed by the 16th Amendment.
Right, and we'll explain that more on Saturday's program, talk in depth about this particular ruling and all of what it pertains to us as constitutionalists and conservatives. But going back here, we're looking at this issue that the big problem is that when John Roberts was brought forward for and his name was put into nomination by George H.W. Bush, or no, excuse me, not H.W., but W.
Right.
Bush, yeah, the younger, Bush the younger, conservatives were like, woohoo, yay, we've got ourselves a great conservative who sat there in his confirmation hearings and said that he would abide by stare decisis and wouldn't answer questions about various portions of his philosophy. But the interpreters out there were saying, oh, look, we see, oh, this is what this means, and this means that he's solid on this, and this means that he's going to be great constitutionally, and this means he's a total strict constructionist. But, Chuck, I don't think, and even not just in this particular ruling, but in a number of others, John Roberts has proven that he's probably at least the rotor when it comes to the expansion of federal power.
Right. The fact is, Barry, that the people that were talking about strict constructionism had no clue what strict constructionism entailed. The people that were telling us that really just didn't know what they were talking about. In fact, if you tried to do a strict constructionist viewpoint, that would mean dismantling dozens, if not hundreds, of federal agencies and basically saying, these are unconstitutional, they cannot exist. And that would include things like the EPA, which essentially was created by presidential fiat, which is absolutely unconstitutional, and yet there it stands as a cabinet position.
Absolutely.
And things like health, education, or housing and urban development, and the education departments would disappear, things like Social Security would disappear if we took a strict instructions viewpoint. Frankly, Barry, that's not going to happen. Now, that being said, we're out of time. So I have to say, join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies where we will continue the discussion.